Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, the fight for Hong Kong. A decade ago, thousands of protesters filled the streets to demand democracy. Now, those same streets have gone quiet.
On the surface, life is the same, but that's what a political clampdown is like.
What's changed for the city and its people? I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take.
My name is Patrick Falk. I'm a journalist from Hong Kong. I was born and raised there. I haven't lived in Hong Kong for a number of years now, but still keep a close eye on political developments there and am frequently assigned to report on the changes that are taking place in Hong Kong.
Patrick was there a few weeks ago, just before the government passed a controversial security law, referred to as Article 23. This law has been in the works for a long time. More than 25 years, and it's been protested against for about as long, too. It gives authorities new powers to crack down on all forms of dissent.
It includes a range of new national security crimes, including treason, espionage, external interference, and disclosure of state secrets.
The tough penalties include life imprisonment for treason and insurrection.
The passage of Article 23 has been expected for some time now. None of this has come as a surprise. The spirit of democratic reform has been snuffed out, you might say. People who oppose Article 23 generally don't speak out about it because there has been a sense of the inevitable, and many people now feel numb to the political changes that have taken place.
The government argues the law is necessary to keep Hong Kong as a global financial hub and, quote, protect core national interests. Here's Legislative Council member Regina Ip.
We will become more prosperous, more safe, more secure going forward. And this legislation is good for everybody, for the country and for the entire community of Hong Kong.
Article 23 was passed unanimously and without much public reaction. It's a stark change from the last time lawmakers tried to push it through in 2003. Back then, 500,000 people marched through the city to block it.
People simply don't dare to stand up and speak out now because the price you pay for it is simply too great.
We spoke to a community organizer who knows firsthand what that price looks like.
I'm Samuel Chu. I'm a Hong Kong American that works in pro-democracy organizing in both the U.S. and around the world.
Samuel has been part of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement since before it was even recognized as a movement. To him, the starting point wasn't on the streets of Hong Kong, but in Beijing.
I remember, actually, even early on before the pro-democracy protest movement, I used to go around the neighborhood with my dad, who was a minister at that point, and just actually listen to people's concern about their daily life. And when the Tiananmen Square protests started, my father naturally gravitated towards organizing people to support it.
1 million demonstrators have filled the streets of Beijing, and there have been demonstrations for democracy in all but two of China's 26 provinces and regions.
That's what people were most concerned about at that moment, and that they were thinking about their future, not just what's happening in Tiananmen Square, but the impact that it would have to Hong Kong and to Hong Kongers. My father actually went up to the square as the representative for the organizations and people who were supporting from Hong Kong to deliver supplies and money. So I actually had this personal connection because for weeks, I was watching what was happening in the square, knowing that my father was actually dead. I was seeing it not just from the eyes of someone watching television in Hong Kong, but I was seeing it from someone that I care about and love was there in person.
After the Chinese government cracked down on the Tiananmen protests on June 4th, 1989, Samuel's father helped smuggle activists out of mainland China through Hong Kong.
So in the months after June 4th, I used to spend evening and weekends in these safe houses in Hong Kong where, you know, students who had just escaped from Beijing would be staying and living at, waiting for their visa to go to France or to go to the US. And so in a way, my father created this clarity for me about what abusive power could look like and does look like in real life. And both the courage, also the creativity that goes into resisting.
This spirit of resistance is what Samuel thinks sets Hong Kong apart. It's also what many feared would be lost when the territory was handed back to China from British rule in 1997.
And at the stroke of midnight, history edged Hong Kong out of the arms of Britain. A century and a half of imperial rule ended with the lowering of the Union flag.
Under British rule, despite the fact that it was a colony of Britain and it didn't have direct democracy, Hong Kong was one of the freest society by all measures in terms of economic, in terms of rule of law, in terms of freedom of movement, freedom of the press. All of those things that did not exist in China was present in Hong Kong. The fear was that Hong Kong would then lose all of these unique freedom and rule of law that were different from the mainland.
China's leader at the time was willing to make a concession to ease those fears.
So, long story short, Deng Xiaoping came up with this strategy, this catchy slogan called One Country, Two System. The deal was that Hong Kong would be handed back over from British rule to Chinese rule, but that to safeguard the freedom and institutions and the difference in rule of law in Hong Kong, that China would agree to maintain those autonomy and all the separate institutions that Hong Kong had for at least 50 years, from 1997, and that they would have its own system. That's why they had their own constitution called a basic law. So the one country, two system was supposed to be the guarantee, the protection that kept Hong Kong autonomous and separate from the mainland.
Mainland China still did set limitations on Hong Kong's self-government, but people like Samuel hoped that in 50 years, Beijing's system would become more like their own, rather than the other way around. And the protests against Article 23 in 2003 seemed like proof that the city would not bow to the state.
For years, no one even in the puppet government administration in Hong Kong would dare raise Article 23 because they thought the opposition was so clear that it would be suicide politically for them to bring it up. And that is a continuation of what you saw, right? For Hong Kong, even though they didn't get to vote for the chief executive, they knew that they could demonstrate their power in numbers, publicly, and that it worked.
And then in 2014, Hong Kongers wanted to push back again in what became known as the Umbrella Movement. The movement was demanding the right to elect political candidates of their own choosing, rather than politicians that had been pre-screened by Beijing. But this time, the reaction from authorities was different.
I think the moment that the police fired the tear gas into the crowd on the 28th of September, I was there on the street when they first fired their first tear gas canister. I think something ruptured between the people of Hong Kong and the perspective of their relationship with the government. I think that all along there was always a sense that, yeah, like, I mean, they have to do what Beijing said ultimately, but at least that they have some say, right? But that crystallized moment where Hong Kongers begin to realize very real sense that the Hong Kong government never and will never represent their interests and their welfare and their aspiration.
Samuel's father was again a leading organizer, but for the first time, he was arrested for his activism.
You know, my father has organized hundreds of protests since 1989. He has never been arrested and prosecuted before. Something has changed. And I knew the moment I stepped into the courtroom, listening to the proceeding, that they were going to be convicted no matter what. And that was a different, a new chapter.
It also signaled the start of the next battle. A few years later, in 2019, the Hong Kong government introduced a bill that would allow suspects arrested in the territory to be sent to mainland China for trial.
What this means is that people like my father would most definitely be extradited and tried in mainland, because Beijing no longer has any patience in allowing Hong Kong to deal with its own processes and departments and institutions.
The bill sparked a new wave of demonstrations that were the largest Hong Kong had ever seen.
The organizers of the pro-democracy movement say there were 1.7 million protesters.
And among the most violent.
Street battles that turned into brawls and seemed to go on forever. In one dramatic moment, a first for these protests, an officer pulled out a gun and shot an 18-year-old protester in the chest.
I think that by then it was clear that from the experience of 2014 was that that formula didn't work anymore, that too many people didn't even get the government to respond. They just said that we're going to keep going. 2 million Hong Kongs be damned, we will keep going.
Then, in 2020, the government in mainland China decided to get directly involved themselves. It enacted the National Security Law without going through Hong Kong's legislature. A spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry called the decision an internal affair.
Hong Kong matters are China's internal affair. Foreign forces should not interfere. The legislation of the National Security Law belongs to our national jurisdiction. This is a necessary measure taken to effectively protect national sovereignty and also a fundamental solution to ensure the stability of the one country, two systems.
Beijing finally said that, you know what, we can no longer use the sort of intermediary. So they announced the National Security Law, which is that they decided to violate the one country, two system and the Hong Kong Basic Law and say that we're going to bypass your legislature. We're going to start to regulate and essentially crack down on dissent directly from Beijing. We're going to send law enforcement and security police directly to investigate on Hong Kong soil, which was illegal under the Hong Kong Basic Law. That was really then the beginning of the end.
After the break, how Hong Kongers who speak out are feeling the consequences, even from outside of Hong Kong.
Welcome to Necessary Tomorrows. My name is Ursula. I am an AI, and I have inferred from your online activity that you have been feeling more dread than hope when you think about the future that is coming for us here in the 2060s. So I have created a course just for you to enhance your capacity for imagining different futures. Necessary Tomorrows, an audio series by Doha Debates and Al Jazeera. Find it where you listen to podcasts.
When Hong Kongers were protesting their government's new extradition law in 2019, Anna Kwok was watching from her university dorm in the U.S.
Being miles away from home made me really want to contribute even more and made me miss home immensely. So my way out and my solution to really cure that sort of alienation was to do those activism and campaigning work online.
Even after the protests ended, she continued campaigning as director of the Hong Kong Democracy Council based in Washington, D.C. But this has made Anna a target. Last July, she was put on a list with seven other activists accused of colluding with foreign forces and incitement to secession.
I woke up one morning to my colleagues knocking on my door and they were shouting, "Anna, Anna, wake up. You're now wanted by the Hong Kong government with a bounty." I did not understand what they meant by the bounty. I mean, I understood the arrest warrant because I saw it coming. The organization I'm directing is already sanctioned by both the PRC and the Hong Kong government. But a bounty, it's a new thing that the government has come up with. So they put a 1 million Hong Kong dollar bounty on my head, saying that if anyone could capture me or provide them, you know, good information about my whereabouts, they can claim that reward.
At first, the idea of a bounty seemed laughable to Anna.
Because it was so absurd, right? Like, how do they expect someone to take action here in the United States to abduct me and send me, you know, on a plane or something? I don't know. And send me back to Hong Kong is just ridiculous.
She did receive some death threats online.
People were saying, oh, someone please drop this girl's unconscious body at the Chinese consulate.
But recently, the threats have felt much closer and more real.
In November last year, I went to San Francisco to protest against Xi Jinping because he was in town to have his bilateral talk with Biden. And that was the week I realized, oh, this bounty actually has real, you know, safety concerns and implications. Because on the streets of San Francisco, there were people following me, telling me, and trying to figure out my whereabouts. And one night, actually, I was sitting down for dinner in a restaurant in the Bay Area. And next to me, there was a table of, I assume they're a Chinese family because they spoke in Mandarin. And a few men on that table started going to the bathroom very frequently all of a sudden. And then they were crossing by our table very frequently and they were using their phones to try to take a photo of me. And it was a scary moment, right? Because I was just there having dinner casually. But all of a sudden, you could feel that tension in the air that people from the next table recognized you and they were thinking about what to do about it.
When she had first started her online advocacy in the U.S., Anna had been anonymous, but she revealed her identity back in 2022. The bounty came a year later, and despite the risks, she doesn't regret it.
I don't regret one thing. I could feel a huge chilling effect among Hong Kongers after the national security law was implemented in 2020. You know, I saw people who were active online deleting their profiles. And I also saw organizers who were very active and very committed in 2019 eventually disappearing, not joining any event anymore. That got me thinking, if everyone chose to succumb to fear, then what would be our future? There would be no future, right? It's the same right now after the passage and enactment of Article 23 that I could feel Hong Kongers shying away even more from political participation. But at the same time, I think if you want something so much, you have to fight for it.
Samuel, the community organizer, also has a warrant out for his arrest in Hong Kong. He faces the same charges as Anna for his lobbying efforts in the U.S. He's the first foreign citizen to be targeted by the national security law.
I'm not being persecuted for what I did in Hong Kong. I am purely being persecuted to proceed for what I've done outside China, which is highly unusual. You don't think of that as being like, this is not how you become a dissident. But, you know, all joking aside, like, I was very much concerned and worried about my family because I knew that that was really where the most severe leverage existed for the government, was that my parents were in Hong Kong, my brother and his family was in Hong Kong. My father was still serving his suspended two-year sentence for organizing the 2014 protests. And the moment that the news hit, that I knew I was never going to be able to go back to Hong Kong again until there was a change in the regime in Beijing. This is exactly what I warned people in the U.S. about. This is exactly what I've been telling them from the beginning, that this will not stop at the borders in Hong Kong. This is not just about Hong Kong. That people ought to pay attention that I'm an American exercising my American constitutionally protected rights, and now I'm being pursued by a foreign government on American soil.
The prospect of return has felt even more distant after the passage of Article 23. Rights advocates have called it the final nail in Hong Kong's coffin.
As far as the freedom, the autonomy, a future that is democratic, it's now not just in, you know, final nail. I think it's underground, like a few, like 100 feet with dirt over it, and then another layer of like concrete, and then it's been like built over.
But Samuel also thinks that the extreme lengths needed to pass these security laws show that the movement is not over.
They had to press all the opposition leaders. They have to change the rule of the election and purge every opposition politicians. They have to change the way that every function or process of government was being done for them to get to this point.
And he hopes to get back on track by returning to where things started.
I'm not sure that what one country, two system for 50 years, which basically translates to be 50% free for 50 years, I don't know if that ever was going to get us anywhere, right? That's not how freedom works. That's not how democracy works. And this is why it's so important. I think about my early days in Hong Kong, and particularly in 89, so often, is because the generation that started in 1989 wasn't fighting for a free Hong Kong. They were fighting for democratization of China. And that's actually where we are back to now. It is now our job to not just reinvent what the Hong Kong pro-democracy looks like, both on the ground in Hong Kong in a subversive underground way, but also overseas. But also, this is our time to say that we're going to light as many fires as we can, because you never know where the actual fire is going to catch on. I have no doubt whatsoever that I will be back in Hong Kong again before I died. I have absolutely no doubt.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Miranda Lin and Sariel Khalili, with Nagin Oliayi, Zainab Bezer, Amy Walters, Ashish Malhotra, Chloe K. Lee, David Enders, Berenice Campana, Khalid Sultan, Sonia Bagat, and me, Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Alexandra Locke is The Take's executive producer, and Nay Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back tomorrow.